Unfortunately, I have to leave back to France tomorrow, but I really, you're very lucky to be here. That inspiring and exciting place. Okay, so today I think that I'm going not to give the same talk as last week, because everybody has heard that talk. So the outline of what I'm going to say is just a very short summary of what has been said basically last week as regards to the cosmic ray anomaly and the excess of positrons. Then I will try to summarize a little bit what I've understood about the discussions as regards the various particle physics models that could lead to a dark matter species that has the correct positron excess signal. And I will spend, in fact, actually most of my time here on that third section, which has not at all been discussed last week, which is the fact that when you want to boost the annihilations of dark matter particles in order to have a sufficient amount of positrons to be produced and to explain the pattern of data, you may try actually to explain that with astrophysics. And you may try actually to rely on the existence of quarks. And so since we've been working on that in the past years, I'd like to show you and what we've been doing on that. And I will try to examine a variety of our situations where we may have actually a large boost factor, and other situations where, contrary to what we would expect, the boost coming from astrophysics is very small. And of course, then we will briefly conclude. So, as we've seen in fact last week, we are interested here in the cosmic ray anomaly because that may be the first hint of the presence of dark matter species floating in the halo of the Milky Way. So, you've seen already that plot. If dark matter species are in the halo of the Milky Way, they are annihilated from themselves. They will generate, among other products, rare antimatter cosmic rays. And those antimatter cosmic rays, we can now detect them with a host of various experiments. Namely, Panna has measured recently the positron excess and has measured also the flux of antiprotons. And the important thing is that, well, we know that those species are produced by regular processes in the Milky Way as sort of the background here in green. And last week, I spent most of my contribution to the conference in explaining that it's important to model the cosmic ray propagation in order, in fact, to have a good handle on the various backgrounds above which, well, putative dark matter signal lies. I will not repeat what I've said last week. The only thing is that, well, when we deal with cosmic ray propagation, we have to use a model and we have to solve a diffusion equation. And the only important thing here on which I'd like to just to put the stress is that, well, as regards antiprotons, we know basically that they propagate a long range before they are detected at the Earth. That will come out to be important for the astrophysics boost, as we will see in the middle or at the end of the talk. The green function here describes the probability for an antiproton to be produced at some point or to be detected at another point. And so the green function, or the extension of the green function, at least the region where the green function is non-zero, gives you a flavor of the region over which you are going to drag the cosmic rays which you detect at the Earth. So of course, well, for antiprotons, basically, the green function varies as one over r, so it decreases very fast when r increases, r is the distance between the source and the Earth. But because you integrate over all the sources around you, in fact, the integral of the integral of one over r over space, well, diverges, and basically, well, you are sensitive to remote antiprotons. And so when you detect a signal with antiprotons in general, you see very far away. So what was said also last week was that as regards antiprotons, there is no distortion in the expected signal. In the yellow band lies a variety of predictions as regards the antiproton signal. And the yellow band corresponds to secondary antiprotons, those which are produced by the interactions of cosmic ray primaries on the interstellar matter. and everything seems to be fine, and okay, there is no excess for the antiprotons, no cosmic ray anomaly for antiprotons. As regards positrons, there is, of course, a cosmic ray anomaly. There is an excess in the positron background. I flashed these transparencies very shortly to remind you that as regards positrons, it's the reverse as for antiprotons. The positrons here is very restricted as soon as the energy increases, and the reason is that you cannot, in fact, detect a high-energy positron, which has been produced from far away, because that guy is going to lose energy on the way back to the Earth, and diffuses, loses energy and cannot come from a remote region. Very well. So the point is that, well, as regards electrons and positrons, there are also the Fermi measurements, and the Fermi measurements that are shown here with the red points and the gray band could be explained, in fact, with just standard electrons and positrons, electrons that are accelerated by supernova shockwaves, and the positrons and electrons that are produced by secondary processes. But you cannot explain the Pamela anomaly, which is a large excess, in fact, in the fraction of positrons, namely positrons over electrons and positrons. So there is indeed, okay, an excess in the positron, and so this is why it's called the Pamela anomaly, the fact that you have too many positrons at high energy, and the yellow band is the prediction as regards the production of spallation positrons, positrons generated as secondary antiprotons by the interactions of cosmic ray primaries on the interstellar gas. So we already know that, we've seen that before, and there are a variety of explanations which are purely astrophysical for the Pamela excess, and in particular, pulsars, for instance, could explain both at the same time the Fermi measurements and the Pamela excess. So the Pamela, well, cosmic ray anomaly, the positron excess, could actually be in nature just a normal astrophysical process that is explained by the local pulsar.
But could it be just an instrumental error that they misidentify somehow protons at some small rate?
I doubt it because, well, as Maxim points rightly, in fact, as soon as you have a reconstruction of the protons, then if the proton population spills a little bit in what you would recognize as a positron, of course, well, if your rejection factor for protons is not large enough, you mimic very well, in fact, that signal. But I know this is all very well-known stuff in particle physics. Maybe the instruments were not that good enough 20 years ago, but now I doubt it really. I trust the results. Okay, so I've shown already this. I don't want to bother you too much and too long with this. So now back to the second part of the talk. So the second part of the talk is based on the fact that we are very excited by the positron excess, because that may be a hint of the presence of darker particles annihilating and producing, in fact, positrons. So the problem here at that stage is that when you have darker species annihilating themselves, you know that the annihilation rate at some point of the Milky Way halo is just given by the ratio of the annihilation per section by, in fact, the square of the dark matter density. And it turns out that, well, you need, in fact, to have a very large enhancement. I flash you here a plot which was produced by Sun Group, Leszek Truskowski and his collaborators, where they run, in fact, a supersymmetric model, and they scan the supersymmetric parameter space. And you can see here, you have lots of parameters in supersymmetry, so they used a certain incarnation of the supersymmetric models. And they just show here that when you run all the various parameters and try to fit in a few constraints, such as, for instance, the Rydberg abundance or B into S gamma, then you find out that you lie on that red band here, whereas if at the time, 2 years ago, that's all physics, this is pre-Pamela data, when you had here the heat excess, because the positron excess was already measured by heat, and it has been remeasured then by Pamela with much better accuracy, then you could see here that you need a large amount, in fact, of boost. You need to enhance what you, in principle, do expect in order to explain the signal. So that's one thing we have to get in mind. In order to explain the Pamela excess, we need to have a large enhancement of the annihilation rate. And so that has been a lot discussed in the conference. So here,
this was just a generic Bibi bar state at the end, or
here?
Yeah, they
I guess that they take a point in the parameter space, and then like they get the branching ratios and the sum of the branching ratios.
Which is Bibi bar and W.
This I don't know really. I would say that it depends. In some regions of the parameter space that is going to be the case, but I don't really know in detail which states they were what were the various decay products. I agree that in most cases it's Bibi bar. Okay, so the section two will be focused on the fact that everybody has been interested in trying to boost the annihilation rate with cross section. So I'm going to discuss that, how can we boost the annihilation rate with cross section. And what I'm going to say, in fact, falls along those lines. Very rapidly after the publications of the Pamela excess, people claim that could be, in fact, the internal Bremsstrahlung. So I'm going to discuss that. It turns out that people are extremely excited by the Sommerfeld effect. And you have some specialists of that Sommerfeld effect in the audience. That also there could be a modification of the thermal decoupling. So let me first of all discuss the two first points. So in the two first points, you want to take into account the internal Bremsstrahlung and the fact that you have final state conditions when you produce, for instance here, electrons and say positrons, and you attach that gamma. So Lars Bergström and his collaborators found that when you have that radiation in the final state electron or positron, then you could, in some instances, when the photon has a large energy, you can have a large production of photons. And they use, in fact, that reasoning to, in fact, deduce that the annihilation to positrons would be also enhanced. And so you have an enhancement factor arising from the fact that the intermediate electron or positron here is basically on shell. So you may have significant enhancement by huge factors, but the point is that, well, that huge factor, in fact, enhances a cross section which, in that case, is not large enough. And so the problem is, in fact, that when you work out both the enhancement coming from that effect and you compute the correct annihilation cross section, you end up with a signal that is not large enough to explain the Pamela delta. I should have said, but everybody knows that, that in principle we believe that with the good solution to the dark matter puzzle because of what is called the Wien miracle, which is that they are produced in the early universe as long as their annihilation cross section is 3 times 10 to the minus 26 cc per second. So as soon as you plug that, in fact, in your calculation of the signal, you end up with a positron signal which is very small. And so in spite of that final state radiation and internal Bremsstrahlung effect, Bertram and his collaborators concluded that they could reproduce barely the Pamela excess, provided that they got on top of actually what is given by the supersymmetric model boost factor of order 10 to the 4, which is just unrealistic, as we're going to see in a moment. So this, in fact, doesn't explain the large cross-section. So everybody has concentrated actually on what is called the Sommerfeld effect, which is that at low velocity you may have long-range forces between the two annihilation points, and the Sommerfeld effect, well, classically is well understood when you take the sun and the celestial body that in fact hits the surface of the sun. If the body moves very slowly, then its trajectory will be deflected, and then the effective cross section becomes much larger, in fact, as long as the velocity of the incoming body is small. So the Sommerfeld effect is just a quantum translation of that. And it turns out that you may have significant enhancement of the cross section. That effect has been known for quite a few years, actually, and it has been noticed first in 2002 or 2003 by Japanese people. The fact that you may find, in fact, that effect arising in a class of models where you have the dark matter rim here that annihilates into a light scalar of vector has been first of all proposed by Maxime and collaborators last year, and that it was not at all in the framework of Pamela. That was just as an interesting way to promote indirect detection, because they wanted, in fact, to disentangle the direct cross-section, scattering cross-section on a nucleus, so they could have a very small interaction cross-section on nucleus, and so have very, very weak direct detection signals, but on the other hand side, they could have a large annihilation today, with a small annihilation compatible with the omega density really today. And so then they remarked that, they called that secluded dark matter. And then this idea has been revived, in fact, last October by Maxim and Adam, and by the Princeton gang, in fact, led by Nimar Kanyamed, where they use the same kind of model to try to explain actually the Pamela data with a five particle that could have just decayed, and which could be long-lived and could just decay into E plus amounts. So the idea is that, well, when the cross-section increases as the velocity decreases, the fact is that when the particle decouples in the early universe, the cross-section may be compatible with what is necessary to produce the relative abundance. And when time goes on, the velocity decreases and the cross-section increases by, say, the two required orders of magnitude to explain the family excess. So people have worked a lot on that and proposed this. There is a third possibility for a large cross-section that arises from, in fact, the slightly modified scenario in the early universe. So we had, during the conference, an interesting contribution where the model which I showed you has been reanalyzed in the framework of the thermal decoupling. And it was shown that you could live with an annihilation cross-section in the early universe five times larger than the, so to speak, canonical thermal value of 3 × 10⁻²⁶ per second. But there are other options. For instance, I've been interested in past years, for instance, by scenarios in which the expansion of the early universe at the time of the neutralino decoupling is triggered by the by a scalar field which is in a kinetic stage. And so the expansion of the universe is much more rapid and occurs at a faster pace than what is believed. And so the decoupling is such that you need to have larger cross-sections in order to have the good relative abundance. So you may have a much larger cross-section than what is believed in order to get the good relative abundance if you perturb, in fact, the history of the universe.
Do you need also a larger baryonic fraction?
No, I've not worked that out. No. I mean you don't. Let's see. If you have a kinetic stage, then you're worried about how the baryon fraction is produced. But you could really accommodate a much larger baryon fraction.
Yeah, that's precious.
Sure, yeah, that seems. We need to produce a larger baryon fraction. Okay, so basically, there are problems with the other messengers. And so it was shown, for instance, right away last August that we would have a large production of antiprotons. For instance, this is what occurs if you have 150 GeV wind that annihilates into W plus W minus. You can explain the Pamela excess, but you barely explain the attic, but it's not really a problem. But you are saturated as regards the antiprotons, so you have no production of antiprotons. Whereas if you, of course, have that heavy particle that annihilates into mu plus, mu plus, mu minus, you don't have many antiprotons, and so people were interested in electrophilic particles. So we've been also interested in that. Let me just show you this. We've been interested, for instance, in setting constraints on the production of antiprotons, trying to explain at the same time the antiproton data and the thermal excess. Let's consider a 1 TeV wimp. That wimp annihilates into W plus W minus with the thermal cross sections of 3 times 10 to minus 26 cc per second. You need a boost factor of the annihilation rate by 400 just to barely fit the thermal excess, whereas, in fact, the same boost applied to the same model in the same with the same propagation model gives you, in fact, a very large enhancement, in fact, here, being of 400, doesn't fit the antiproton data. So it was immediately concluded that actually the wind should be electrophilic. Now, in my summary of that section, I put a question mark because I think there are ways that people have jumped to rapidly on conclusions, and we need to plug in a little bit of astrophysics. For instance, just assume that, in fact, that factor of 400 comes from increasing the cross-sections by a factor of 40 by some little effect. And you increase, in fact, also the annihilation rate astrophysically by the effect of crumpiness, which I'm going to discuss by a factor of 10. I will show you that for antiprotons, presumably, there is no astrophysical boost. For positrons, there could be a large astrophysical boost. And so you could have, for instance, the possibility to reconcile a large boost factor for positrons from a much smaller boost factor for the antiproton. So I'm not absolutely 100% sure that the wind has to be leptophilic. We have not worked along those lines, but I don't know of any work where people have analyzed actually some other possibilities, mixing in fact the astrophysics with particle physics. There is also something which I've not shown here, which is that the calculations that are performed here are performed within a specific set of propagation parameters. If you change that set, if you take another, for instance, what we call the minimal propagation model, the positrons will not be that much affected because they are local, whereas the antiprotons may be really depressed. And so I think that could be also a possible way out of that leptophilic thing. Anyway, beware of the other messengers. Here, in fact, and we had a lot last week also, you have lots of constraints arising from the other messengers. If you want to explain the panel access, you need here. So these are the famous Chiarelli-Gang plots. There are numerous plots like this. So in principle, they try to fit the panel access in terms of the annihilation cross section versus the mass. And they consider a variety of annihilation channels, E plus E minus, mu plus mu minus, and tau plus tau minus. And what they try also to fit is either the attic bump or the Fermi data. And they plug a variety of possible limits arising from astrophysics. Namely, in fact, you have the gamma ray emission from the galactic center. But you need to know pretty well, actually, what is your. You need to know pretty well what is your dark matter density. Then you have the gamma ray emission from the ridge. You have the radio emission because when you produce charged particles and mostly electrons and positrons, this spiral in the magnetic field, and you have the radio emission. So, for instance, here you have either a constant magnetic field or a magnetic field that increases when we go towards the center of the Milky Way. So you have a variety, basically, of bounds, and I've not come to any precise conclusion. It's really, in my opinion, it's really, this question is really a mess. today, because you have so many possibilities as regards the dark matter abundance at the center of the Milky Way. You have a variety of hypotheses as regards the magnetic field that you can always, in fact, try to constrain the dark matter particle models from those arguments from the radio emission. And here is a paper published basically slightly more than a month ago, where they computed, in fact, the E-minus production, which interacts then on the stellar light and that produces gamma rays. And those gamma rays are detected then by the various instruments, and they can plug a limit on this. But you can see here that the kind of prediction which you have depends, of course, on the kind of channel, and also here on the kind of profile which you claim at the center of the Milky Way. But even if you take, for instance, the isothermal profile, you reach the conclusion that you, in fact, exclude the large masses. So in all those models, in fact, you postulate that you have a smooth dark matter distribution, that you increase the cross-section, and you have limits, in fact. And I'm not particularly convinced by all these analogies, except that, all right, for large masses here, you can you cannot, in fact, accommodate at the same time the Penman explanation and the other astrophysical explanations. And we had a discussion at lunchtime, and I think that, well, this, you know, you have to seriously work out the all those constraints. But in my opinion, well, although this one seems, of course, to forbid the presence of heavy masses, they rely always on a certain number of assumptions. For instance, what is the density of stellar light close to the galactic center? What is the magnetic field at the galactic center? What is the dark matter density at the galactic center? So okay, we can say that most of those explanations of the Damon excess relying on a large annihilation cross-section seems to be forbidden by astrophysics. I would be a little bit suspicious about that, and I would say that there are interesting limits, but they are not absolutely sure. This is why I put here a question mark for that second section here. So now let me turn to the main thrust, in fact, of my talk, which is the astrophysics enhancement of the dark matter annihilation. So people have tried to work out large cross-sections with a smooth halo. What happens if you get, on the contrary, an ordinary cross-section with a thermal value of 3 times 10 to the minus 26, and try to see if you can enhance the annihilation rate by enhancing, in fact, rho squared here. So it's known that with numerical simulations, we tend to have, in fact, a large number of crumbs in the Milky Way, and because the average value of rho squared is larger than the square of that, the average value, you expect to have a significant enhancement, significant, or you expect to have some sort of enhancement. So that enhancement was, in fact, used by people who, for instance, ran extensive calculations using supersymmetry or extra dimensional models, where they worked out the flux, and in general, the flux was depressingly low with respect to what you would see. And so this people used, in fact, to wave their hands and say, we have clumps in the Milky Way, so we're going to have an enhancement because of that. And it seems that, well, what was necessary is to analyze thoroughly that enhancement. As I'm going to show you, well, the boost factors is a hazardous, not that hazardous, but it's a kind of magic, because in fact you have to rely on statistical analysis, because all this is just statistical, in fact. Okay, so just to sketch the things and to make my point clearer, just take, well, some model and just assume that was a paper 2 years ago, a preliminary paper. Just assume that we have a distribution of plants, and we take, and the only thing which is interesting here is that is that you need to know that the closest clump is at 1 kiloparsec. So what happens when you have that clump put closer to the Earth? Well, you take it at 500 parsec, 250, 100 parsec, and of course, what if it's at 70 parsec, bingo, then you get a very large announcement. And if you think, well, a good way to explain the Pamela excess or any sort of excess because of the clump which is located close to the Earth. So this is really something which has not been discussed in the workshop. And I think this is something which may be of interest for you.
So what's the overdensity in the clump?
So I come to that, because I try to explain. In fact, this is just a pedagogical example. Don't take it that too seriously. I'm going to give a few definitions now, actually. So what is the overdensity? What is the boost factor? Or everybody talked about astrophysical boost, but really I think that we have to define a few things. So how probable, in fact, is this? And this is all what I'm going to discuss now. So to answer Maxime, in order to conduct a statistical analysis, you see risk aversity. So when you have a smooth distribution of dark matter, well, in general, you can compute the flux in a smooth distribution, which is just given by this expression here, where you recognize the particle physics part here, where you have basically the cross section. And here in the cross section, you can play on that cross section, it increases as much as you can, but I'm not going to play on that, I'm going to play on the other part. The other part, in fact, depends on two things, the dark matter abundance and also the Green function that describes the propagation of cosmic rays from the point of production down to the Earth. And so you have those two things, and you have to play with that. Now, this is with a smooth dark matter distribution. Now, if you have clumps, and we will assume that clumps are quite localized, so that they behave as punk-like clumps, so dark punk-like, then the flux, well, has still a smooth part, and we believe that not a lot of dark matter in the smooth halo is in the form of clumps. And you have a large contribution rising from the clumps. So each clump is punk-like. And the important thing, Maxime, is that when you want to compute actually the flux put by one clump, you have that still particle physics. You have the Green function that locates the clump to the Earth, that connects the clump to the Earth. And you have this, which is very important, which is called the annihilation volume, which is the integral, in fact, of delta rho, which is, in fact, very big, delta rho squared over rho sort squared times the volume. And so the dimension of this is a volume, and it gives you the volume that a dark matter solar density would occupy in order to get the same number of annihilations. So you can translate this in terms of a boost at the source. So let's take an example. Just assume that the clump is twice as condensed with respect to the solar density. So if you do that, delta rho over rho is a factor of 2, the square is a factor of 4, but for the same amount of mass, then you decrease the volume by 2. And so all in all, then you get a production of signal, which is just a factor of 2, and B of I will be that factor of 2. So the thing here is that, so I've defined the annihilation volume, and because the clumps are located in the Milky Way randomly, in fact, the boost, which is defined actually, and which is as not to be identified with B of I, the real boost, which is defined as the flux which you receive on Earth divided by the flux you would receive should you have only a smooth distribution, that boost factor is in nature is statistical. It has a random behavior, and so we have to try a random analysis or a statistical analysis. So this is what we did, in fact, basically 2 or 3 years ago, and the paper has been published in ANA. We decided that, well, the actual distribution of clumps in the Milky Way is one possible realization over, in fact, a large and basically infinite set of such random realizations. And so what we will be interested in here is actually the real value, of course, is what we measured. But when you do statistics, you're interested in the average value of the random flux and its variance, and basically as regards the boost factor, which you get on the signal, you're interested in the average value of that boost and on its variance. So one thing that you can assume, if you want to, I forgot to tell you that either you do a Monte Carlo simulation, or you try to do things analytically. So this is the analytical analysis, and I will show you that we did the same things, in fact. We both did analytical and Monte Carlo simulations, but for the IMDH, but we come at the end of the talk. Okay, good. So let's assume that the clones are independently distributed from each other. So this, I have no good motivation for that. There may be some correlation then between the presence of the clones, although in fact we are not worried by this correlation as long as the length of that correlation is much less than the length which is typical of the propagation. But if we assume that the clones are independently distributed from each other, then immediately things become much simpler, because if n of h, the number of clones in the Milky Way, you end up with an average random flux, which is in fact the number of those clones times the average value of the flux given by one clone, and the same thing arises for the variance of the random flux squared, which is just.
So you could have clumps within clumps or subclumps. So
exactly.
Yeah. What about them?
Yeah. So I agree. So this has not been taken into account, but if you have I agree. So as long as in fact the big clumps are not quite large enough, so that they are seen from the Earth with basically the same green function, you don't mind actually. As soon as you start to have that correlation length that will tell you that in some part of the Milky Way you have many, many clumps of some sort, and on the other part you don't have any of those clumps, then you're in trouble. I agree. But in all the simulations, when you see the distribution of the clumps, they seem in fact to indicate that correlation length is not large enough, in fact.
Have clumps within clumps.
I agree, you have clumps within clumps. But if the large clump, say, has a typical size of 500 parsecs, so that's fair, that's okay. Okay. But I agree that we've not taken that into account. So now the point is that we are just basically interested in the flux given by one clump, and we're interested in the statistical ensemble, which is realized by the various locations of a clump around us, and also which takes into account the annihilation volume. So P of the position and of the annihilation volume is the probability that matters here. And the probability basically that one clump, a single clump, gives you a flux phi at birth will be given by this expression here. It's dp, that is the probability distribution function as a function of the single clump flux. So that is given, in fact, of as the integral over d of phi of, in fact, the probability that a clump lies at some point x, and the probability that he has also some annihilation volume. And this is just a sketch of the parabolic space where d of phi, which is given in blue here, gives you, in fact, the domain d of h over which, in fact, in the parabolic space, when x and psi lie in that domain, you get the flux phi. So equipped with that formalism, the calculation can be right away performed, because if you take any function of the flux, large f, you can compute its average value by just, in fact, using the probability distribution function of the Planck in terms of the position and of the annihilation volume. And basically, you end up with an effective boost factor, which you can just compute, which analytically is just given by this expression here, where n of h is the number of clumps in the Milky Way, I was that integral over the smooth distribution function of dot of rho smooth squared over pseudomatrix d squared times the green function, and you have to compute the average over the clump distribution function of the product of the annihilation volumes times the green function. and that chromatism is helpful both for positrons, antiprotons, and for any cosmic ray species, and also for gamma rays. And you can work out also the variance. So I don't want to bother you with these expressions that are not quite complicated. When you take an average value, that's that integral which you perform all over the halo of the Milky Way, where you integrate, in fact, you integrate over all of the Milky Way halo, G times psi, for instance, in that case, with that probability distribution function. So the net result is that as regards the astrophysical boost, the first conclusion is that because the Green function enters, the propagator enters in the effective boost, the boost factor depends, in fact, on the energy. And it has a variance that depends also on the energy. So this is very pedagogical. It has nothing to do with reality. So in that example, we took an NFW.halo with a density profile as 1 over R. We assumed that we had clamps with all clamps with that kind of mass, either 10 to 4 or 10 to 5 or 10 to 6 or masses. We assumed that the boost at the source on the PRI, which I showed you in two or three transparencies ago, is equal to 100. And you have that cubic shape of the boost, which is computed in the case of a positron line, which corresponds to the injection of 100 GeV positrons, and you detect them at the energy E. And the interesting thing is that, in fact, to understand that plot, first of all, you have the boost, the effective boost that depends on the energy. And the reason why the boost decreases at low energy is just given by the fact that you are sensitive to larger and larger regions. And although, in fact, your cramp produces lots of signal with respect to a solar matter, a solar dark matter density with respect to a low dark environment, as soon as your positron sphere is very large, you are going to drag, in fact, a significant portion of the Milky Way, of the dark matter halo, and you are going to be sensitive to regions in which, although the cramp seems to be very bright at the place of the Earth, that cramp will not shine that enough with respect to a larger value of the smooth dark matter density.
So, sorry, I don't understand. So you talk about a single clamp now?
Yeah, I'm taking a constellation of those clamps, and I'm doing I'm applying the tools which I devised. Uh-huh. And so, for instance, here, take the red line. The red line corresponds here to 10 to the 6 solar mass clamps. So if you want to have a typical Milky Way halo with that fraction, 20% is made of clamps, then you have a certain number of clamps, which I don't have.
So what is the 100? You said BC is 100.
BC is 100. BC is this thing here, is the thing which enters, is the thing which enters in that calculation here.
So it's the boost at the clamp or on the clamp or something?
Yes, it's the boost of the clamp.
It's at the clamp. Okay, so if you're inside the clamp, this is the boost you see?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So it is as if you had, say, a constant dark matter density with a density 100 times larger than the solar value, basically. So you tend to have a production which is enhanced by a factor of 100 with respect to solar density, which is real solar. So when you go to a region where, say, the dark matter density is 10 times larger, in fact, with respect to that density, which is 10 times larger than the solar neighborhood, you see that the clump, in fact, well, relatively to that larger and richer dark matter density, shines 10 times less than it would shine with
respect. So you fix the density of the clump, no matter where in the Milky Way they are.
No. I'm going to show you now the results of the real results. So this is just to stress that when people used, in fact, that boost factor, they always shifted upwards the signals and never took into account the fact that the boost depends on the energy. Now, of course, while we have to run an accurate and precise calculation, because Adam asked me about that paper by Gordy Kane, where Gordy had seen that plot and he said, well, everything should be like that. So Gordy is using actually a boost that depends a lot on the energy, but you have that plot corresponds to a very non-even pedagogical example just to show that, first of all, the boost may depend on the energy, first thing, and then the variance of the boost depends, of course, also on the energy, Because when you've got high energy, you are sensitive to the local region, and you have larger events if you have large objects that are very simple. So now my colleagues Julien Laval and David Morin, who with Chinese colleagues, applied that mechanism to real lambda CDM simulation. So the idea is that you have a variety. So they went through the literature, and there have been lots of simulations trying to see, well, the sub-halos, the sub-sub-halos, and people have tried to work out actually the results of the simulations in terms of what is the mass density, mass distribution of the resonance, and it turns out to be something like one of the mass to some power, and basically 1.9. So here is, for instance, the fraction, the cumulative mass fraction of currents above the value which is given here on the horizontal axis, the fraction of the Milky Way halo. Should you take that form for the distribution function of currents, and alpha varies from, of course, the extreme 2.1, where everybody is in forms of currents, and where you tend to have 10% if alpha is equal to 1.9 or 1.8. And you have that famous concentration plot. The concentration is basically the ratio of the virial radius, which is something which is very unphysical, divided by the scale radius. So in those simulations, you believe, well, for the biggest current, this is what you see, and then you extrapolate very low masses, you believe that the mass density, the distribution profile of the current will be given by a law, which is basically this, where the density rho with respect to r varies as one of the r, so it's basically never Frank and white here. Then you have r minus 2, which is also called r of s, where the slope changes and is basically minus 2, and here the slope becomes minus 3. And so you try to, in fact, relate the concentration C is given by the radius, the virial radius divided by that R of S. And the virial radius, the virial radius out of that is the fact that relates, it's the mass, so the mass of the crank is given by 4 times pi, the virial radius cubed, times some sort of an average density. And the average density, you write that it's something like the cosmological matter density today times some value delta. In a totally dominated universe, delta is 100, sorry, in a matter dominated universe, delta is 180, better value would be 340. So you have various things to take into account. What is the slope of the mass distribution function? What is the concentration as a function of the mass? The simulations, in fact, give you that concentration for the large masses, not for the very small masses. What is the minimal mass for the crown? And all those sort of things. So my colleagues worked that out, and they varied actually the carrier of distribution of crowns in the Milky Way halo, varied the inner profile inside crowns, varied alpha here, that parameter here, the minimal mass, the concentration to mass relation given either by that curve, like this one, and they ended up with the fact that the boost, in fact, cannot exceed a factor of 20. So you have two plots. The upper plot gives you, in fact, the positrons, and it's basically the same as before, except that you inject a line, a positron line at 200 GeV. And you realize that for the same reasons, the boost tends to increase and the variance is large. But the boost cannot exceed a factor of 20. And for the antiprotons, it's the reverse thing. In fact, at low energy, you seem to be more sensitive to the local region, whereas at high energy, you probe down to the galactic center.
This is a statistical conclusion, or I mean, suppose I don't. I'm a god. I'm designing the clumps, and I put some, you know, over density very near to us. You know, or something that is very.
I'll come to that in a minute.
Because that's like a cosmic variance.
I'm a transparency in that. This is just a statistical thing. It tells you that what is an average, the boost, and what is, on average, the variance. So if you are a god, you can always decide that, okay, for enough, you can boost something here. But you can see actually that it's not inconceivable that the Auclair proton are still okay, because you could have, you know, an energy, a small boost here, and for the positrons, a large boost. And you have, if you are a god, you could even say, well, I'm at one sigma above the limit, and I'm going to have a very large sigma. Yeah, you could say that. Although we have very, you may need more than just that. You may need also Sommerfeld. So if you're a god, Sommerfeld is nevertheless something. So this is actually what we've been interested in. So the, on average, the general conclusion is that the boost cannot exceed 20.
So if you're not the god, but I mean, so I just want to get an idea.
Maxim is
the god, yeah. Right. So is it exponentially suppressed, like these sort of scenarios where you would be living in very unusual?
I think so. It's a very good point. I think that so let's see. The statistical law, yes, is Gaussian in principle. Unless you have very, very small numbers at stake, and then you start to run into Poisson noise, and you can't say lots of things. So if you have a large number,
I think it's a power law. I don't think it's a...
No, you're right. It's not a Gaussian. It's a Gaussian when the number at stake is very large. And as soon as the number is very small, you have the Poisson distribution. Yeah. So what is your comment? Is it exponentially suppressed? What is the probability for that?
Yes.
You can, okay, it depends. Really, it's a question of the number of, basically, it's a very simple, but I hope that I will remember. So if you have a sphere and you want to count the number of guys inside, so you just have, you know, a binomial distribution, which ends up eventually to be a Poisson distribution. So if you have, instead, an average value of France, which is large, the distribution is Gaussian around that average. But if the number of inside is very small, it's Poisson. So it's polynomial, exactly. So what have we been, so time is running out. So let me just show you one more thing. We've been recently interested in trying to use now a real simulation where we try to explain the lambda positron excess with one single cloud close to the Earth. And for instance, here on those two plots, we can explain the tabular data with that curve, the blue one here. That curve, in fact, refers to an E plus minus. We assume that the dark feather species are annihilated in 3 plus minus. And this blue line corresponds to the best fit, which is that you put the clump at 1.22 kiloparsec from us. And it has a luminosity that is an integral of rho squared times the volume, which is 10 to the 7. Okay, and we've devised, in fact, the best fit for the Pamela signal. Now you have a 1 dB wind, and also here, and it's complicated here, you have that line, the black line here is the best fit. So a few remarks then, you can always play with those clumps that are close to the Earth, and you can totally modify the shape of the spectrum by the position of the clumps, because you have an interesting interplay between the positron propagation and the position of the clump. So if your clump lies just outside your positron sphere, you're not going to see the clump, and as soon as it enters in the positron sphere, the signal increases. And so when you play with that, you can even have, for instance, here that blue curve with two bounds, where you have a clump at 900 parsecs, and the second one is at 4.3 kiloparsecs. So basically, we did that because we explored exactly what Maxim and Michael were saying. What is the probability to have a single clump lying near us? Okay, and so we devised what in those examples. I just take the plus minus and either 100 giga, and I want to explain them now, or 1 TV and that. And so we used the Yamato simulation. Actually, we walked in the simulation randomly, and we checked what was the probability, in fact, that a single clump would explain the phenomenon. So, for instance, here you take that curve here that is the best fit to explain the phenomenon excess for a 100 GV wind. And you find out that the basket corresponds to that point in a plane where you have on the horizontal axis the luminosity, and on the vertical axis the distance to the Earth. And the Via Láctea, when you walk in the simulation, tells you what is the probability to be in such a place, or to have a clump which is at that position, in fact, in the plot. And you can see that on average, this is where you lie in the Via Láctea 2 simulation. Here you have a 10% of the average, 1% and 1 per million. And so basically here, the probability, so the answer to the question is the probability to explain the Feynman excess with a 1 degree GED being with an E plus E minus annihilation is 0.37%. So I don't know if that's okay for you. If you, we had also a discussion, if you like to rent a car and say I have a 0.37% probability that the car has no problem when I return the car, do I buy the insurance? So it's up to you to decide. But why not?
Things happen, right? You can ask the question, what is the probability that within 100 kilometers there is a point where the water, you know, goes from one lake to another lake and drops by 100 meters, right? You say, wow, that sounds like silly, but it is in 100 meters from 100 kilometers from us, right?
So it's
it's hard to quantify, right? It just happens.
Well, it depends on if there are selection effects, but otherwise, I mean, this is a probable. If you are randomly somewhere in the Milky Way,
I'm just happy it's bigger than 1 divided by 10 to the 500.
Okay. By that standard, all of us are very happy.
So it's a matter of appreciation. So it's up to you guys to decide if you are pleased with that. Unfortunately, if you want to explain both, for instance, the attic and Pamela, and I guess that well. We have not performed the things with the same analysis with Fermi, but I think we will have to do that. Then you realize that you have to lie on that blue band, and then the probability is much less. Remember that, for instance, the smooth part, not the clumps, but the smooth part of the entire Via Láctea 2 halo has a luminosity of 3 times 10 to the 9. So you would like to have a clump which is, you know, as luminous as the entire Milky Way. Anyway, so that's a little bit bizarre.
So that's because you needed 2 clumps, and essentially.
That's because we want to explain things at 1 TeV. So we have a particle with a cross section still, which is always the thermal value, and the mass is 1 TeV. So it's 10 times larger than 100 GeV, and so the number of abundance in the smooth halo is something like just, you know, 100 times smaller. So you need 100 times larger luminosity to explain the things.
Can I ask, maybe you mentioned this and I missed it. Are you assuming that we're in the middle of the plot, or could the plot be off to one side?
We just assume that the clump is point-like, very naively. We assume that the clump is point-like.
So some direction in the sky then, is that?
Oh, yes, in principle, there should be.
It's coming in for the directionality.
So we have not looked at that. No, I agree that in principle, if there is a clump that was it was proposed that directionality would be interesting.
Magnetic field randomizes the direction of the profound field.
Sorry?
Galactic magnetic field randomizes the direction.
And something which puzzles me also, of course, there is this, but although you can compute actually the diffusion of that, you can compute, there is nevertheless a preferred direction. But I'm wondering about the heliosphere, the fact that in the heliosphere, I'm not sure actually that it will destroy completely the anisotropy. I've not discussed that with people working in this.
Does AMS-2 have any detection of direction of electrons and positrons?
I don't know. I think that, in principle, they know where they are coming from because they can reconstruct that in their detector. But, you know, if you point in some direction and before you, you know, organism anisotropies are very, very difficult because you have to have a total coverage of the sky, which is fairly homogeneous. Because if you look at almost the same direction, of course, we're going to say that it comes from that direction. But No. But I had a discussion with people about the fact that in cosmic ray propagation at 10,000 TeV, we have an anisotropy which is kind of small, but when I discussed with experimentalists on the way they measure that, I was not that convinced that there was no bias. Anyway, so I think that just a few transparencies. If you're interested, then I can discuss that more later on. We're reading actually the same kind of analysis in some, but not, sorry. So we're reading the same kind of analysis. So I just want to hear that section to answer two questions as regards the single comp. Is it probable? So the answer is, in my opinion, no, not that much. Although you can read maybe with 0.37%, but you will never live with that. Now the second thing is, what are the other constraints? And so with Torsten Brinkman and Julian Rand, we worked out the constraints arising from egress. And I'm pretty sure that the constraints from the gamma ray emission from Fermi will be much, much more constraining than what I'm going to show you now. So let's concentrate once again on the middle panel where we still have one TeV wind that annihilates into E plus minus. Then you can see that in the plane here, it's not per section. We just assume that we have a single plane whose luminosity, that is the number of this time of annihilations per second, gamma is given here. So gamma will be sort of the annihilation per section times, in fact, the integral of rho squared times dV, and you have one of the mass squared. So basically, gamma is the amount of annihilations per second. Just to set the stage, here is the amount of annihilations in a standard Milky Way smooth halo here, at that level. So if you want to explain Pamela here in the light gray, and basically it's all that band, in fact, here, you need to sit with a gamma value, with an annihilation rate, which is enormous, which actually we already found here. Because if you want to explain things with a 1 TeV species, you can see here that that guy is basically as luminous and even more than the Milky Way. So you are at that level. You are basically as luminous, slightly more than the entire Milky Way. And so this is the annihilation rate. This is the distance to the Earth of a single clump. And if you lie above that line, your the egret constraint of 2 × 10⁻⁷ photons per square centimeter per second excludes, in fact, you to be above that line. So you need to be, in fact, on that range. But if you fold in fermion, those are very fresh results. So I hope that we did not make any mistakes. Then you exclude the dark gray area. So if you still want to explain Pamela in that scenario, you need, in fact, to be in that part of the plot with, in fact, really a distance or order just a few kiloparsecs, but with an annihilation rate which is enormous, which in fact, in terms of probability, is very small. So maybe difficult with ordinary clumps coming from a simulation to explain that. So this is why I wanted, but I'm just going to sketch you the results, talk about IMDH and the mini spikes around IMDH. There is a scenario that has been proposed by Sil, Bartone, and Zitner, where you have in the early universe, 10 to the 7th solar mass primeval dark matter halos that form, that contain gas. The gas is sufficient, there is a sufficient abundance of molecular hydrogen that cooling occurs. Then you have the disk that forms, then the disk rotates, and you have some gravitational instabilities, on which I don't have very clear ideas, but the claim that you could have a loss of angular momentum and parts of the baryons, 50% of baryons that are inside the disk that spiral inwards and form in fact a black hole. And as the black hole is formed, then you can actually concentrate a dark matter cloud around that intermediate mass black hole. So the scenario is as follows. You end up by forming actually a black hole and concentrating the dark matter cloud around that. And the interesting thing here is that you end up with a very large luminosity because you concentrate things with an index. You see, outside that typical mini spike radius, which is, as I showed here, a few parsecs, the profile is given by Emery, Frank, and White, and here it's concentrated and you have a very steep profile, and you have a saturation here just because you reach the annihilation value, which tells you that the rate for annihilation is given by the inverse of the age of the object. And so you end up with an enormous annihilation volume, and we've been playing with that. We've been playing to try to explain things with positron excess with that and try to set limits on this. So let me skip to the conclusion of that part.
So you can explain everything this way, I guess.
For the IMDH, no. Yeah. No. For the IMDH, the thing is that, well, if you have those IMDH, then you can see here that they are severely constrained by Grant, definitely. And they will be even more constrained by Fermi.
From the background or from just the middle?
From the emission. No, sorry. Not from the background, you're right. From the fact that Egret fails to find
a
point source in excess of 2 times 10 to the minus 7 photons per square centimeter per second above 100 meters.
But these aren't points, right? So these are spread.
No, points. These are points. So you look for points in the sky. You look for those points. You look for bright objects, and you fail to see them. So this sets a limit on the parameters, on the cross section versus the mass. So the gamma ray flux is, of course, proportional to the annihilation volume, inversely proportional to the distance squared, and it's a simple function, actually, of the mass and of the cross section. And if you plug that limit, you end up by excluding all what is above the sky. So we recover that. So remember that we have here an annihilation cross section of 3 times 10 to the minus 36 if we want to have the really components here. But if we have, for instance, those IMDH with mini spikes around them, and if you're going to annihilate into BB bar, then you only allow super weak annihilation cross sections, everything which is above the excluded. So you cannot explain the Riddick abundance, and you have problems this time to have the correct Riddick abundance. And instead, well, you can still live if you have a plus and minus and a plus and a minus. So it's borderline. You could still have, you know, a 1 TeV wind annihilating with the Riddick, with a cross section which is just given by 3 times 10 to the minus 26. And here, so you still are below the red line, and you could marginally, in that case, still explain in that case the thermal excess. So you have with those IMPH the possibility to explain the thermal excess. Provided you can play actually with the cross section here, and you can of course take a low cross section because the annihilation volume is enormous. Remember that. One single IMPH is as bright as the entire Milky Way, and we're still working out on the probability. There is still a probability for an IMPH to lie in that ray band. The probability that lies in all this area was 81% before we ordered in the Fermi constraint, and now, of course, we still have to know what is the probability that the guy lives precisely here. But, you know, it's much better than 0.37%. And you have to buy this scenario. Okay, so the conclusion is that single nearby cloud is very probable. The red constraints show that the wind has to be leptophilic, by the way. But, you could still explain marginally with IMPH, although I'm pretty sure that the Fermi constraints will be gamma ray constraints coming from the Fermi supply would be very hard. And this is my last transparency. So the perspectives. So as you've seen, I have no current picture in mind. So it's really a puzzle with various species altogether. So in my opinion, there is still a lot of work to be done, because this conclusion that the winds have to be leptophilic, I think that we have to analyze carefully if cosmic wave propagation has nothing to say as regards that. So the dark matter distribution of the galactic center is not very well known, although I do agree that the latest results by Cirelli and his collaborator on the inverse quantum scattering on the still alive by the plus and minus created at the galactic center were pretty strong, but you can survive with marginally a wonky degree. So, of course, I've not talked about decays, and I think that decays have been showed a little bit, and they seem to be very interesting because in that case, you are not worried about the dark matter abundance, because remember that your signal is just proportional to rho squared and not to rho and not to rho squared. You don't have a boost factor this time. Although I think that, well, the annihilation, the decay rate, sorry, should be able to 10 to the minus 26 or something per second. And although you have to find and devise a model that's like that. So we heard during the conference, and Michael has also a model. These collaborators have a model where they can have quite naturally that kind of decay rate because of dimension 5 operators. Maxim and his collaborators, and Michael and his collaborators.
We're the first collaborators.
So you guys have thought all about that. The Japanese guy who came to my lab, and he had also a model with gravity suppressed contractions. But beware of the fact that still you need to have the correct decay rate. I think you have to work out the decay rate up to a factor of, say, 2. And maybe if you look into the details, maybe that will be 50%. So. But that's really something interesting. Last thing. And this is under scrutiny. You may have a very nice combination between both Sommerfeld and the clumps. Because we know that in the clumps, the velocity distribution is small. So we may have an astrophysically Sommerfeld-enhanced factor. So that then you may think of just evading all those limits coming from the galactic center. Because we know that there are no clumps there, because they are totally disrupted. So because of that, well, you could think even of trying maybe to explain both the positrons and the antiprotons because of the various distributions of clumps. Okay, so I thank you very much for your attention.
Yes, just understand. So for this Y limits on the gamma ray fluxes, and assuming that there is a point like clump nearby, right? Suppose, what did you do exactly? So you were supposing that things, for example, annihilate leptons, there is always a probability of emitting photons.
Exactly.
That's like.
Yes. The order was
3 or 10 to minus 2 probability of emitting a photon, right?
Yeah, I think so. You compute the number, in fact, you compute the number of photons generated in a single interaction. So, let's see how it goes.
I just want to understand.
You compute the final state radiation, in fact.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, you compute that. So if you have the plus minus, mu plus mu minus. Of course, if you have BB bar, then you have many more numerous.
And so if by any chance there is a monochromatic line, there would be even a better sensitivity to this? Or is that
it? Let's not look at that. Of course, well, as soon as you have a monochromatic line, Here we work with the Y constraint that tells you that you don't find, there are some other statements, but you basically do not find any source that is not recognized as an ordinary physical source above a flux of 2 times 10 to the minus 7, the point type, the point source flux, it's not the diffuse, the point source flux of 2 times 10 to the minus 7. Photons per square centimeter per second from, that was great, from 100 MeV onwards.
So it's energy integrated.
Yeah, so it's energy integrated. So I guess that if you want then to get a line, we should use indeed this time Hess. Because Hess, at least Hess is much more, I don't know, well. Sorry, Fermi will have a very good energy measurement. That's correct. For a line that would be better, but I guess that the line will be even more suppressed than just the final state radiation.
Who knows? Maybe you produce quinons or something.
Yeah.
Or something in association with a single gamma, right?
You see, well, of course, well, the line is very interesting because this is something which is impossible to fail with astrophysics. At least for now, we are pretty sure that the line would be very difficult and would be a smoking gun signature. Although well, this kind of reasons can be used actually to tighten the limits.
So lambda CDM is not very well understood on a small scale. So inflation could do funny things on small scales, for example. So let's say that you can make astrophysical boost as large as you want because you don't understand, say, the matter power spectrum or subpayloads on very small scales. Is that enough to explain everything? If you just have astrophysical boost arbitrarily large and keep the same WIMP scenario, but make astrophysical just arbitrarily large?
I think that then you are in this, you are then in the, once again, you would have to carry on a complete analysis of the signals.
Yeah.
But you basically sit, in fact, here in the IMPH scenario, because you have an enormous boost. You have few clamps, although, because they are very luminous. Then of course, you will be worried that if you have a large astrophysical boost, then you don't have to exceed already the astrophysical limits. You have to pay attention to that. So either you have numerous clamps, and then your boost cannot be very large, because in that case, you are going to be saturated. If you have, for instance, each clamp is 100 times less bright than the entire Milky Way, you can't have, of course, 10,000 of those clamps, because you are going to saturate the limit. But I don't know, actually. If you have numerous boosts, then you start to have an average boost factor for the gammas that is below the limit. Now, for the positrons, let's see how it goes. If you have numerous clamps where the boost is sufficiently large as to mimic, in fact, and to have the proper rate, that's the thing that no. That would be okay. Yeah, it's basically the sum of the stuff, actually. That would be okay because you don't have, you're worried by the problems at the center of the Milky Way. So if you can avoid that because you don't have any clamps at the center of the Milky Way, fair enough. That's okay. But people are working out those limits now, and I've shown a few of those limits, but there are no, in my opinion, systematic analysis of all the limits mixed together to have a complete and coherent picture. But the recipe is known. You have to pay attention to the radio emission, to the gamma emission, and this kind of limits. So I would say that yes, you could find something working out.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Final questions. Let's thank Pierre again.